This week on C-SPAN's Afterwards podcast, Dr. Elizabeth Komen looks at the medical history of women's health and discusses how the narrative around women's bodies was shaped mostly by men. She's interviewed by Muhlenberg College Medical Humanities Program Director, Jacqueline Antonovich.
Hello, I'm Pam, and joining me today is Zach as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Pam. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now, with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach so that no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
As we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
So, here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Dr. Elizabeth Komen, welcome to Afterwards and congratulations on your new book. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So before we get into your book, I actually wanted to talk to you a little bit about your journey as a physician. So you received your MD from Harvard Medical School. You then completed a residency in internal medicine at Mount Sinai. And you're now a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan, but you received your BA in history and specifically the history of science. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your academic journey and how your undergraduate interest in history sort of has shaped your medical career.
Right. Well, I was really fortunate as an undergraduate at Harvard. They offered this incredible concentration, this major that allowed us not to have to choose between science and humanities, because I always knew I had an interest in medicine, but really the ability to combine the reality that we know, which is that science and medicine does not exist in a vacuum, and that it's inextricably linked to culture, politics, religion. And for me, I loved history, I loved old books, I loved the context of who and why we are the way that we are. And science and biology grounds an understanding and gives us the language to speak about the way that our bodies work. But I've always been fascinated by understanding the lens with which we understand science. And that has carried me through to this day. That learning really helped me understand the narrative aspect of medicine. And as an oncologist, so much of what I do is, yes, about the biology and the science, genetic mutations, but perhaps even more so the stories that patients tell me about themselves, about what makes them want to live, what helps them thrive, and how I can best help them in that journey.
Yeah, it's clear to me that your history education and your medical career profoundly shaped this book that you wrote, because it's really an interwoven tapestry of meditations on how the past informs the present. And even in your introduction, if I can quote from it, you write, quote, "The past is a presence in every doctor's office and every research institution, in medical exam rooms, anatomy cadaver labs, hospital hallways, and operating rooms. It haunts our footsteps as we navigate the medical maze of women's health that was built by men whose ideas about women, while sometimes well-intentioned, were limited at best and paranoid, misogynist, and abusive at worst." So can you talk a little bit more about this historical presence in medicine and how it and maybe how it motivated you to write this book?
Absolutely. So in my career, I've taken care of thousands and thousands of women. And over time, as I became a mother myself and as a daughter caring for women in my family, listening to the stories of women and experiencing them myself, I became overwhelmed by these narratives of women feeling dismissed, invalidated for their pain, shamed, blamed, and also understanding just how broad or how much broader the landscape of women's health really is than what I understood it to be, even from my own medical training. And for me, trying to unpack that legacy that infects us when we show up at the doctor's office today, whether as a doctor or patient, meant from my training really going back in time to better understand how was this system built the way that it is. I know, Professor, you have an interest in history as well. That is your career, and I honor that. And in my world, I really think about every body that we are in and show up in has a history. And the only way for us to collectively understand how we can make our future better is to really understand the history of what we come from. And for me, that meant head to toe, looking at all the ways that I do think that women have been dismissed. And yes, I write about the men that created the system that we're in. And the aim of the book is not to say, oh, there were these horrible men and all they did was terrible things and that no one had any good motivations. Of course, history and human nature is far more complex than that. It's really more to understand the context of which our system was built and how do we reframe that context and perhaps develop a new and better narrative moving forward.
Yeah, and I think you do a wonderful job of capturing some of that complexity. And I hope that we'll get into those details in a moment because you're right. It isn't just this sort of simple narrative of, bad men doing bad things, but that, as you write about,
Of course.
it's a very complicated story. But I think that's actually a really wonderful transition to get in to talk about, some of the book. Your book is called All in Her Head. And it's really an appropriate title because it really does capture the essence of how male physicians in general have historically approached women's healthcare. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about this, especially the notion that women's health complaints have historically been dismissed as even mere as fantasies or even mental illness.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, it took a while to come up with the title of the book, but once we did, All in Her Head, it just immediately clicked because when I say the title of my book is All in Her Head, almost every woman has a story to tell me. Oh my gosh, when I went to the doctor, I was told this or I was dismissed that. So it was this thread that kind of wove its tapestry into the cultural narrative that I felt that I was really trying to explore. In terms of better understanding the history and unpacking some of these stories, one of the things that was so striking to me in my research is how much of the historical focus on women's healthcare was that we were just vessels and hormonal vessels once we discovered those hormones. You go really back in time to the Greeks, we're all hysterical from this wandering womb that presumably was untethered and was the nature or the basis for all our medical ills. And once we knew throughout history, obviously, that we were not subject to a wandering womb, it then became our ovaries. And then more, once we had the discovery of hormones, that we were all bathed in this estrogen that was making us formidably crazy. But the lens with which our bodies were studied was really as this atypical, imperfect, irrational version of the reference male. And that theme is carried throughout medicine, even insidiously to today.
Yeah, and in the book, you provide example after example of sort of complicating some of these, what we might call sort of heroes of medicine, and along the lines of, this idea of dismissing women's healthcare. I was particularly, as someone who teaches the history of medicine, I was particularly struck by your example of the renowned physician William Osler, and his belief that heart problems were not necessarily attributed to heart disease. And I'm wondering if you could share some of that story.
Yes. So, throughout my medical training, including when I studied the history of medicine, Sir William Osler was this godlike founding father of medicine in the United States. He was this Canadian who moved to the United States and ultimately founded the residency system at Johns Hopkins University as we know it today, and really the father of so much of the medicine that we practice today. And when I went back in time to really understand, okay, why is it, if we think about the present problem, that heart disease is the number one killer of women in the United States? We also are taught in medical school in many instances, certainly during my training, that the way that a woman presents with heart disease or a heart attack is atypical relative to the man. Okay, let's sit with that for a second. We are greater than 50% of the population. It is the number one killer of women in the United States, and somehow our symptoms are not average, are not typical. That's simply ridiculous, and it really highlights this how important the legacy of the words that we choose to describe women's health disease becomes so important. And for me, it was necessary to go back in time to understand who laid the groundwork for this. Now, of course, Sir William Osler did amazing, absolutely incredible things for medicine and had so many discoveries. But when it came to heart disease and going back to his original treatise and textbooks about what he wrote about women's heart disease, it's really shocking. Case after case after case, he describes Mrs. B or Mrs. C, because they all just got an initial before them, as having pseudo-angina or even hysterical angina. Angina refers to chest pain. Basically, our chest pain is fake or our chest pain is hysterical. There's even one line in, I just read it the other day, there's even one line in the textbook where he says, these women do not die. Of course, that's not true. We do die. It's the number one killer of women in the United States. Then when you look at how he describes the classic man who has heart attack symptoms, he explains, oh, this is a man who's hardworking, he's white-haired, with his engines running and running and running, and then he collapses with this elephant-like pressure on his chest, and that is the classic imagery of a man having a heart attack that you expect to see in an emergency room, because that's what you're taught. You see it in movies, and it's part of the public lore. And then what happens is, when women have heart symptoms, they're not as aware of what they might be because we've not been taught, and then it's too often missed by doctors in the hospital.
Yeah, and he makes several appearances in your book, right? So it's not just about, yes, you know, sort of the heart disease, but also even thinking about IBS, right?
Exactly. So one of the ways that I did the research for this book was to simply say, what are some of these female predominant conditions that I hear day in and day out from interviewing other experts in other fields or even from my own patients? Irritable bowel syndrome, we know, is a more female predominant disorder, as are some gastrointestinal disorders. And I went back in time to say, well, who were the first people that coined these terms or first discussed these medical conditions? And then it was an act of show, don't tell. I just needed to explain in words, not in, in their own words, what they said about women. So one of the first articles by William Osler and others was called Mucolous Colitis, and it was about, again, symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. And what was shocking to me is so much of the article was about the psychological condition of these patients and not really trying to understand the physical biology of it. And when I thought about my own training and what are some of the biases that I inherited, when I even spoke to a gynecologist the other day who said to me, you know, I was afraid for my doctor to put IBS in my chart in my past medical history, because I knew that the moment that happened, I would be seen as a difficult patient. And going back in time to what William Osler and others said about these women who were diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome, of course, there's this whole narrative about those patients are more difficult, more challenging to take care of. And no one wants to arrive at the doctor's office with a scarlet letter before they've even had a chance to explain what their symptoms are. That's what this is really about. This book is unpacking the idea that before even women get to the doctor's office, they arrive with shame. They arrive apologizing. They arrive blaming. And that just simply has to stop, because we're not allowing women to truly access better care.
You know, I think one of the really great things about your book is how you weave in these, you know, past and present narratives. And, you know, what you're touching on right now about, you know, looking back in time to see where some of these ideas come from, I think is a really important perspective. And I'm wondering, how do you think these ideas that we sometimes think are stuck in the past, how do they filter themselves into present medical education?
I think they filter themselves in so many ways. What was really heartbreaking for me and eye-opening for me is it's one thing to go back in time and to read these just egregious stories and say, oh my God, I can't believe they said that. Okay, we're going to remove women's clitorises. We're going to remove their ovaries. And all women are crazy. I mean, that's easy to say, oh, that's terrible or that's bad. You know what's even worse in some ways? How subtle it can be into today. When I thought about and looked into how often do we ask women about sexual side effects from cancer-related medications in my field as an oncologist, we are 2 times more likely to ask men about sexual side effects than we are women. And I take care of women of all ages. And when I really thought about that, there were many ways that we have left women behind. We have assumed that their sexual life, that the way that they choose to find joy and thrive is simply less important than men or dependent on a male narrative. And that insidious legacy is, again, so heartbreaking when you realize, even for myself as a physician, that I have too drank the Kool-Aid. There were many instances in my practice where I made assumptions about women that were false. And I am glad I wrote this book for myself. It's the book that I wish I had had during my training so that throughout the years I could be an even informed, better doctor to all patients.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad that you brought up sexuality, because really a significant theme in your book is how physicians, particularly male physicians in the past, linked many aspects of women's health to sexuality, whether that was concerns about excessive sexual activity or even their endeavors to sort of medicalize women's sexual desires. And you give numerous examples of this in your book. And can you maybe share some of those examples and maybe think through why do you think there was such a fixation on women's sexuality among male physicians?
Yes. I wasn't expecting to find this the way that I did. I was shocked in my research. At every turn, whether I was trying to study the original diagnosis of scoliosis, whether thinking about asthma, whether I was looking into women's skeletons in general, or the way that we exercise, at every turn, I would find some founding father of medicine linking women's sexual desire, the fear of it, or the need to control it as this looming, I don't even have the right word for it, just looming, overwhelming need to control it, understand it, or prescribe it at a man's whim. So for example, when it came to how we coached women or told women as physicians that they could exercise, bicycling is a fascinating, fascinating example. I was really interested in the idea that why is it that so much of the history of women's exercise is about either teaching them not to, or that the goal is to be thin and small and not strong? Well, at the turn of the century, we know that bicycles were a huge pastime. They were also the symbol of the suffragist movement and gave women mobility from their home. Well, there was another problem with them, that in that mobility, in that symbolism, in that sense of freedom, there were lots of doctors that came out in famous medical journals and in the lay press to say, careful, ladies, this is really bad news for you. If you exercise, well, your face is going to be frozen in a grimace. You're going to develop bulky muscles. But you know what else is going to happen? Your sexuality is going to go into overdrive. You may even become a chronic masturbator and not even be able to reproduce. And I mean, how do we go from exercise to sexual function? It is just mind-boggling to me the number of times that women's sexuality, their desire, is brought up as either something to be feared or something to be prescribed for hysteria, but only with your husband and only when he desires it. So there is this constant thread that we know throughout history and culture and politics of the need to control women and the need to control their behavior. And that is woven throughout our medical system when it comes to women's sexuality and their desire and their libido.
Yeah, I think one of the favorite examples that you provide in the book is the bicycle example. But I think you're right in that analysis that you give, is that there is the bicycle in some ways seems like it's a metaphor for women's independence, right? You have this lovely example of like a concern about women, that maybe it's okay if they ride bicycles, but just not too far, right? We don't want them to go too far. And when I was reading it, I really read this as, again, an example of men's fear over independence through this, examination of sexuality. And when I teach this particular history to my students, especially when we talk about the fear of female masturbation, my students always find it really funny. And, there is an aspect of humor there, but I do think what you're saying is correct. And I try to emphasize the real implications for women's agency with these medical diagnoses. And I know this is true for the past, but how do you think these ideas have entrenched themselves into sort of medical practice today?
First of all, I'm so thrilled that you teach this to your students, and clearly we are cut from the same cloth, and it's incredible to know that there's education going on today for the future and the future even better. I think I see this left and right. In my practice in particular, so I take care of a lot of young women who we may have to thrust into chemical menopause because of the nature of their cancer being driven in by estrogen. And so there are women in their 20s who we have to suppress their ovarian function and give them further medications that downregulate the amount of estrogen that they produce. And this happens just immediately overnight. There's no gradual progression into menopause or natural progression. This is from one day to the next, their whole world changes. And throughout my career, up until very recently, the idea that their sexual function might be important to them was completely neglected. This was not something that oncologists routinely addressed by any means. Even research to understand how we might be able to supplement from a sexual function and from a physiologic function some of that estrogen to improve their sexual function was really something that was ignored. Only recently have we start to really think about for that population how it might be necessary and helpful. And then when we think about menopausal women, well, with the discovery of hormones, you'd think that there would have been more attention to actually how we might be able to make women feel better. But the pendulum has swung in so many different directions. And now with a huge percentage of our population menopausal, it's as if we forgot that older women might want to have sex as well. It's really horrific, and we're still playing catch up with this dramatically.
Yeah. I think this is a really good moment to move a conversation to talking about another big point in your book that I think still resonates today. And this is this sort of historical tendency to pathologize women's bodies. And I think that this is actually really evident in your very nuanced examination of plastic surgery. And as you correctly note, the field initially focused on rehabilitating injured soldiers. But throughout the 20th century and into today, it's evolved into something very different. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So much of my book is about how women's medical needs are dismissed. Plastic surgery is almost the exact opposite. So as you stated, so much of the history of plastic surgery originated from battle wounds and new ammunition and weapons that were disfiguring soldiers. And so the rise of reconstructive surgeries, along with the ability to operate on people with anesthesia, really revolutionized the field of plastic surgery. Then it also became a field where doctors, male doctors, could pathologize the way women looked, capitalize on this idea that a woman's value is based on her physical appearance and her ability to get a certain type of husband, and that was her agency the world. And so whether it was the ethnicity of your face or pathologizing small breasts or whatever, beauty value that could be placed on a woman, this became something that the field really capitalized on. And let's think about it today. There's in many ways, plastic surgery and dermatology are these incredible fields where we can do beautiful things for people. And I honor that. There is value for many people in vanity and empowering them in the way that they look. At the same time, those beauty standards can be very punishing, and the fields can, both those fields, whether it's dermatology or plastic surgery, may be capitalizing on this idea of women being valued for their beauty and their beauty alone. And so I say to women, I'm all for whatever you want to do for yourself, but think about the history of these procedures. Think about what you're considering doing. thinking about who and why you are really doing it for, and then make an informed decision about how you want to feel your best self.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we were talking at the very beginning of our conversation and we mentioned sort of these complicated histories, this is one area that I think is really beautifully done in your book, you know, because I was struck by your discussion of sort of inventing disorders to quote unquote cure through plastic surgery, as you mentioned, yeah. Macromastia or small breasts, and also the evolution of labioplasty procedures. And yet, I also think that a really important part of your discussion is not only understanding the paternalism and misogyny and the history of plastic surgery, but also, you know, recognizing the complicated motivations behind a woman's, you know, decision to get plastic surgery. You know, and in your book, you write, exactly. quote, you write that complex interplay between beauty and health can make the difference between a patient who is living versus merely surviving. And this was a really beautiful passage. And, you know, as an oncologist, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about that.
Yes, I think the easy thing would be to say, oh, all these beauty standards are just punishing, and to kind of go through the different physicians that, as you said, pathologized parts of women's body, that, okay, now we're going to call small breasts micromastia. And of course, the history of breast implants was not for breast cancer patients and mastectomy patients, but really just this idea that we could give women bigger breasts and we could make this, we could capitalize on the market value of that. Of course, the history is far, far more nuanced than that. And in my field, you know, I've spoken about caring for women of all ages, but a huge part of how anybody feels about themselves can be who they see looking back in the mirror. And for breast cancer treatment, although it's slightly changed in recent years, so much of that affected their sense of self, whether it was the type of surgeries that they had, like mastectomies, and history of some physicians just referring to breasts as useless appendages. Why should it matter for them anyway? We kept them alive. To the loss of hair or the loss of libido and sense of self. And I think when you are really taking care of the whole patient, how women look and feel in their bodies is critical to their sense of self. You may have one woman that might say, you know what, my breasts are not as important to me. I want what's called an aesthetic flap closure, where you remove the breast and you suture it back up, but I don't want any implants. And you have other women who say, this is so important to my sense of self, I need that. And I think there has historically been a dismissal of vanity in women as superficial, as something that we shouldn't care about in the field of oncology, because, well, I've saved your life. And now, of course, we know that to survive is not enough. We want to survive and we want to thrive. And as I said, for many women, that means restoring their bodies to as whole of a self as they could possibly feel. I want to make one point about that. Hair is incredibly important to some women. To others, it may not be. You look at the history of a new treatment to preserve as best as possible hair during chemotherapy, something called a cold cap, where you wear almost like a swimmer's cap that's very cold on the scalp, that decreases the amount of chemotherapy that can go to the hair follicle. And in some chemotherapy regimens can really preserve a lot of hair. For the most part, that has historically not been covered by insurance. Mm-hmm. That is something that women have had to pay thousands and thousands of dollars out of pocket. Now, clearly for women, that may be more important to them than some men. Imagine if this was a male quality of life issue. I almost am certain that this would be more covered, or would have been covered sooner by insurance. Something to think about.
Wow. Yeah. And I think, you know, your discussion about what you just mentioned about not having, you know, maybe access to things like insurance coverage, or, you know, having to pay out of pocket thousands of dollars, really leads to one of the next things that I wanted to talk about, which is sort of thinking about, or at least throughout your book, you also have a recurring theme of, you know, the marginalization or disregard of women's voices, you know, which frequently leads to instances of things like medical coercion or even medical violence. And this is obviously particularly true for women of color. And throughout your book, you discuss this historical intersection of gender, race, and class, and healthcare and how it's directly led to disparities in healthcare, particularly for Black women. So can you talk a little
Absolutely.
bit about some of the stories that you include in your book and how it sort of
Yes.
affects women today?
Absolutely. One of the tragically just sad things to read about in all of my research was just how much misogyny went hand in hand with racism. For all that I'm talking about misogyny in medicine and that legacy that we inherit today, it is compounded astronomically for Black women in the United States, for Indigenous women, for minority women, and it's you see that play out in so many different ways. In my specialty, for example, Black women are 40% more likely to die from breast cancer than any other ethnicity or race. In large part, that's not a function of the type of disease that they get. It's because of access to care. And you see that theme throughout our current experience in the healthcare system across the board, whether it's someone like Serena Williams dismissed for her shortness of breath and actually having a pulmonary embolism, whether it's the woman who going for pain medicine because she has sickle cell anemia and is having an acute pain crisis and denied pain. The idea that women were meant to suffer more and can suffer more is horrifically and tragically compounded for minority women in this country. And there are so many really tragic examples of that, whether it was birth control pills being experimented on in Puerto Rican women, whether it is Dr. Marion Sims, who operated on slaves over and over and over again without anesthesia to try to perfect critical surgeries that we do today that maybe have saved lives, but on the backs of, on the horrifically sad, tragic backs of Black women is something that we have to understand and reconcile in the history of medicine today, to understand why is it that minority women are so poorly cared for in this country across the board.
Yeah, and can you say a
and
little
I want
bit
to say
more?
One other point.
Oh, yes, go ahead.
I was going to say one other thing about that, which is that in order to truly care for everyone in our society fairly and appropriately, we need diversity in our medical workforce. Depending on which field you look at, it may only be as many as 3% or 2% of Black women in those fields. We need to encourage and inspire and have opportunities for young women at every stage of their career to enter medicine. Because I spoke about the importance of women being able to look in the mirror and see themselves back. It's also really important that when women go to the doctor, that they can have an experience with a physician that may look like them, that may have a similar background with them. They may have even better outcomes because of that. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, we can't have different races taking care of each other. Of course not. But it means that there needs to be a diversity in the workforce so that everyone has a seat at the table making the right decisions.
What do you think are the things that are standing in the way of that happening? Like, what do we need to do? What do fellow doctors need to do to broaden this playing field?
There are so many things that we need to do. For me, it really became understanding the history of where we come from, and just how much bias we have all inherited, both as patients and as doctors, when we show up at the doctor's office today. I think one of the things that was so important for my medical career was having inspiring mentors along the way. We need to make sure that we encourage mentors at every level and that we encourage young girls to go into medicine, that it is an incredible field, it's an incredible way to serve the community that has been an incredible professional joy of mine. All along the way, we need to make space for different voices, for different looks. I spoke to a physician the other day. We were talking about how many of us as women have been scrutinized in medicine for simply the way that we look. Again, that is compounded for minority women. And this woman had dreads. She's in her 50s now and said that she constantly had to explain why she had dreads and why she could still be professional and look professional with dreadlocks. That's ridiculous. Maybe your patients have dreadlocks. What's the problem with your having them as well? And I've experienced this in a different level as a woman, but again, I think it's compounded for minority women, and we need to have a diversity of spirits, of ethnicities, of races in our workforce.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I think one of the things that your book does very well is you get to know who you are as a doctor, as a physician, as a woman, as a wife, as a mother. You do a nice job of interweaving your personal stories and your professional observations with these historical analyses. And one thing, and you sort of alluded to this, one thing that I really appreciated about the book is in your conclusion, you sort of confront the challenge of critiquing the very medical system that you're a part of, right? You acknowledge that you've seen the lasting effect of historical biases in your own medical education, and that you've inadvertently sort of perpetuated some of these things. And I guess given this backdrop, how do you reconcile these challenges, as a woman and as a physician? And maybe more importantly, how do you navigate self-care in a sustaining way that you can continue to provide the care that you do?
Self-care is such an interesting term and a trap in so many ways. I think we find many, many women chasing this idea of wellness and looking for ways to be heard and validated in their bodies, in their pain, in their health, in their joy. And I have been a part of that myself as well. Your question really gets to both many sides of it, both as a physician and having an authenticity there about how I choose to practice care for my patients. But another part of my conclusion was being a patient myself, and for all the research, for all of this work to try to empower women, when it came to being a patient myself, I apologized for being sick, didn't want to bother anybody, I minimized my pain, and I ended up in a really bad situation because of it, far worse off than I ever needed to be. And it was overwhelming for me to realize that with all of my research, with all of my resources, with all of my access to excellent care, that I could fall prey to the exact same things I am trying to help women with. I don't have any perfect answers. I think we have an imperfect healthcare system, but I do think that we all need a champion with us, that sometimes when we're sick, when we are anxious, we need somebody by our sides to join us at a doctor's appointment to say, you know what, I know you're overwhelmed. I'm going to be another set of eyes and ears for you. I'm going to help advocate for you. Because that doctor-patient relationship, even if that doctor is there with the best intentions, may be compressed to an only 15 or 20-minute meeting with you, not because he or she wants to be, but because, again, our system of medicine is in many ways broken, and we have to figure out how to partner with an imperfect healthcare system. But I really urge readers to take a step back and realize chances are your doctor entered the field because they really, really do care. We're all under these external forces that get in the way of that beautiful, sacred, and privileged doctor-patient relationship. We can still access that, still get to the heart of the matter, particularly if you're in a trusting relationship with your doctor.
Absolutely. And the care that you show for the patients that you profile in your book is, it comes off in the reading. I mean, you can just sense it as you're reading it. And I guess that's sort of the motivation behind, my question, because I'm thinking as I'm reading this book, how does she and how do other physicians handle this, handle all of this trauma that you encounter, day after day. And, especially, because I'm particularly a historian of women physicians, I talk to a lot of women physicians, and I know that there's a high burnout rate, because we have this weird construct of physicians requiring, especially women, can they have it all? No, they cannot. And so, just thinking through how do we create a more accessible profession for women physicians who tend to, have this expectation of providing more sympathy, right, than typically male physicians? But then how do you sort of survive it, if that makes sense?
Not only does it make sense, I thank you so much for that question. And I don't know if you saw, but I just took a huge exhale when you asked it, because there is so much there and so much that I am still trying to learn myself. But you get at something really, really important. Throughout history, women are seen as being better listeners and having more empathy. You look at outcomes for patients, patients overall do better when they have a female physician, and we listen longer. And there's this other phenomenon across the board when I interviewed physicians at every field, even trauma specialty, even ICU consults, intensive care unit consults, that women will give that mom consult. They'll have that little extra tender care that we do so well as women. One of my real goals of this book is not to say that women are better doctors or that by simply flooding the medical system with more women that we'll end up in a better place. Really to say that if we honor that feminine spirit that both men and women can have, we will have better, empathic, nurturing care in medicine. And for far too long, it's been this narrative that doctors primarily cure and nurses primarily women care. There's no reason why we can't have both, because that is what everybody really wants in medicine. They want the science, they want the surgeries, they want the medication, but they also want to be heard, they want to be validated, they want to be seen as a whole person. There's no reason why women can do that better than men. But yet, when we are asked to, we spend more time with patients, we can therefore see less patients in a given amount of time, we are then paid less, and in turn, if we're promoted based on volume or protected time to go do research, we are less likely to be promoted. There's study after study after study that shows this. And from a personal level, of course, this has been a very, very hard field for me to navigate, because I went into oncology not because I'm some compartmentalized, detached person, but because I do care. Every story that a patient tells me, even if I try to distance myself in some measure, lives in my own body. And I've had to really learn and struggle along the way, falling many, many, many times, to figure out, how do I nurture my own spirit? How do I separate a little bit from that dying mother who could be me and try to show up for my own family when I go home, or even show up for myself? I don't know the answers to that, but I think that more we honor empathy, the more we honor nurturing and know that to fill that bucket takes time. It takes time with patients. It also means that it takes time by yourself outside of work, the ability to find your own joy. One of the things I ask my patients that I love is, what brings you joy? Well, if doctors are not able to have their own joy, if they're not sleeping, if they're not eating, if they're not working out, how can they honor that in their own patients? We need to create a medical system that allows doctors to rejuvenate themselves so that they can show up as better empathic and nurturing physicians themselves.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And what you're saying about, you know, women physicians aren't naturally more, you know, sympathetic than male physicians, and all sort of the cultural sort of learning that women have. It reminds me so much of all of the early debates about women physicians in the field ever since, you know, Elizabeth Blackwell got her, you know, first woman to get the a medical degree in the 1840s. And, you know, there's this very well-known book about women doctors by the historian Regina Morant Sanchez called Sympathy and Science, right? And it's basically this question of, you know, Elizabeth Blackwell argues that women need to be physicians because they're inherently more sympathetic. And another physician, Mary Putnam Jacoby, she argues that we can't make these essentialist arguments, you know, about physicians. And then throughout your book, you bring in examples of people like Horatio Storer and Edward H. Clarke, who are basically like, women can't be doctors because they're too fragile. And
hormonal.
I don't know or hormonal, right? And I think this is particularly interesting to talk about, given the fact that, you know, just in the past few years, women have outnumbered men in enrollments in medical schools. And yet these disparities still exist, as you sort of outlined. How do we move? Yeah. I don't know if you have an answer to this, but how do we move forward?
Well, I think I've heard too many times people say, well, we're getting so much better because there's more medical students who are women and more doctors are entering the field. Okay, that's a great start. But how many of those women are being promoted? How many of those women who may choose fields that involve more continuity of care or spending time with patients, how many of those are being valued for the type of care that they're providing? Why is it that so much of institutionalized medicine is about your ability to discover a gene and not really how you care for patients? I think that's a big problem in medicine. And I think the next frontier is really how we honor patient care and how we infuse that feminine spirit that's been sidelined for so long in medicine and bake that back into the system. And that's not a numbers game. That's an ineffable measure of quality. And we know we can't put a number on that. There's no percentage that we can provide for that.
Right. Yeah. You know, I actually want to turn back to the book for a moment, because one of the things that I wanted to make sure that I asked you was something that I personally, as a historian, haven't really thought a lot about. But when I read it, I was like, yes. And that is your discussion about sort of these male physicians' ideas about the women's bodies and how that's impacted women athletes. And you point out that it's only recently that researchers have started to seriously examine gender disparities in sports injuries.
Yes.
And just one example, and I was really interested in your discussion of concussions and how the science hasn't really turned their attention to women athletes or even domestic violence survivors.
Yeah. So this whole idea of a female athlete is, you know, kind of scary, right? And it was not until Title IX that women were really allowed to enter sports and partake in them to the same degree as women, or to the same degree as men. And throughout history, recent history, the idea that certain sports injuries were going to be more predominant in women, the science and the field has yet to catch up with that. When I was 14, I tore my ACL. In my knee. It's a ligament in my knee, which we know now is an injury that can be up to 9 times more frequent in women and soccer players, basketball players, any sport where you plant and cut. When I first had that injury, my orthopedic surgeon, a famous orthopedic surgeon, said to me, well, let's see how active you become over the years. Well, that ligament is incredibly important for any stability in the knee. And we're still trying to figure out how we operate more successfully, how we train women to reduce these injuries. And there are so many different injuries that female athletes can have, and the ways that we need to encourage women, for example, to strength train, how to land better, how to jump better, that's specific to their bodies, is really an area of under-researched and under-attention. One specific example of that is also concussions. We think about concussions in football players, and I think it's fantastic that we want to protect the brains of football players with new helmets and new protective precautions. That's essential. One of the things in reading my book was, or researching my book, was learning how women may suffer more consequences, long-term consequences from concussions from sports, but also this epidemic in our country of concussions and domestic violence patients. I had no idea about this despite taking care of thousands of women, but one in every 4 women in the United States is the victim of severe physical violence at the hands of an intimate partner. So you may have a police officer coming to you or a doctor talking to a patient who is there for some sort of injury, and they can't fully explain their story because they've been hit in the head. And someone may assume that they're drunk or high or not giving a full story. But many of these women have been repeatedly hit in the head and suffer lifelong consequences from those injuries. And that's simply, an epidemic in this country, and one which our medical system does not adequately address. When that woman enters the emergency room for stitches on her head, that's not the first time we should be caring about the violence she's endured.
Yeah, it occurs to me that there's also this sense of, getting back to the Osler example and women and heart disease, you know, men and boys, so much in the culture, are sort of taught to learn to look for signs of, you know, heart attacks or concussions. If they're in sports, there's protocols, everyone's looking out for that. But it occurs to me, you know, from heart disease to, you know, concussions, oftentimes women themselves aren't really taught to, or and therefore don't think about, looking for these signs.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a long history going all the way back to Eve and original sin. We are taught to endure. We are taught to suffer. And in that, we are also taught to care for everybody else but ourselves. And we see that in female physicians going the extra mile and feeling to be the most empathetic version of themselves and not take care of themselves and miss their own mammogram. We see that in the mom suffering with incredible discomfort during menstruation and just assumes that the heavy bleeding is normal because all the women have had that in her family. We see the woman who may be suffering from Alzheimer's disease, that's 2 times more likely in women than men, But who's caring for the elderly women in our country when they've often cared for the rest of society themselves? There is so much more that we need better in that narrative, not just about looking for signs and that men have been taught more about what's wrong with their bodies, but also that we can't be normalizing women's suffering. We can't be normalizing their endurance. We can't be normalizing their ability to be a mom, to work as a doctor, and also suffer. That's just simply unacceptable. And so many levels of medical care, we see that happen time and time again.
Right. Well, who do you think is the audience for your book? Who do you want to be reading this book? And what do you hope they get out of it?
Well, of course, I hope women of all ages read this book, but I also hope that men read this book. I know that, you know, it's pink on the cover, but you can read it too. We don't have to have that bias that this is only a book for women. Of course, I hope that medical students, doctors read it. But what I really, really hope is that for the woman that has wanted to feel better, wanted to thrive more in her body, been afraid to ask her doctor just that one question, think a little bit more about the inherited legacy that she lives with in her own body. And after reading these stories of other women going all the way back in time, all the way up into the present, is there a different story to tell yourself about your body? Could that story be a little bit more empowered? Could you feel a little bit more empowered, even in illness, so that for the time that we do have, we all can thrive and live our best lives?
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I also think that for that woman that you mentioned that you hope reads this book, I think that your book also does a nice job of normalizing physicians, right? Sort of recognizing that you too, you know, are struggling with a lot of the things that other women struggle with, doubts, insecurities, all of these things, right?
I got all of them packed into my history. I'm working through the same things, and I am right along with my patients doing the best that I can.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually also want to ask you, and this might be sort of an odd question, but, you know, as a historian reading through your book and your end notes, I can see the wide influence that historians have had on your book and your work. You know, you cite historians such as Judith Leavitt, Deidre Cooper-Owen, Susan Reverby. Who are some of the historians that have inspired your work besides the ones that you mentioned in your book? And what books do you think other physicians or what historians should other physicians be reading?
I have two names for you, and I hope they're listening. Mr. Kelly and Mr. Dudley. Mr. Kelly was my elementary school history teacher. And for my first essay exam in history on Egypt, I was so nervous. And he said, just tell me everything you can. And I just never stopped writing and I never stopped reading till he took it away from me. And Mr. Dudley, my high school history teacher at Brookline High. These were the most formative teachers in my life who gave me a love of learning, a love of history, an awareness that history is not just something of the past, but entirely informs and enlightens our future. I then, in college, of course, had amazing history of science professors and teachers and classmates who shared in that love with me. And yes, this book has over 800 citations. I relished in the ability to go back in time to work with different history of science professors, but also undergraduates who are equally enthusiastic about this work. But when I really think about who inspired me the most, it was my childhood history teachers. Lots of love and gratitude for them.
Starting you early on that love for history. Love it.
Yes.
So I think, you know, what you're saying to me and just sort of getting back to the sort of love of history, I just wanted to also add that, you know, because I'm a historian and also advise students who are pre-med, I think a lot of pre-med students think that they have to major in a STEM, in a STEM discipline. And, you know, your example of majoring in history is really an example of how that's, you know, not necessarily the case. And sometimes how history can, you know, better inform you as a physician. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Absolutely. I think the humanities are a beautiful way to access what it actually means to be a doctor. When you're pre-med, We'll get in that organic chemistry. By the way, I hardly ever use that, maybe a little bit for fun. You'll get in the organic chemistry. You'll get in all your prerequisites. But what it really means to take care of another human, not about that chemistry, not about the biology, but it's about the narrative of medicine, about the stories we tell ourselves about who we are. It's about the experience of illness. And I can tell you, having cared for many, many people over the course of my lifetime and experienced illness myself, that the biology, the title of some disease that you could check off on a multi-choice question or exam lives differently in two different people. The exact same diagnosis could be experienced completely differently depending on where a person comes from. And where they come from has everything to do with their past and the present continuum. That really comes from history, that comes from art, that comes from all the humanity, it comes from poetry. So I think it's fantastic when pre-med students, yes, do their prerequisites, but also engage in the bigger aspects of the world. Because when you really think about what medicine is, it's about how we all want to live better, how we want to suffer less, and that includes how we find joy. So much of how we find joy is...
Yeah, well said. I guess, you know, I want to know what's next for you. Are you planning to write another book? As I was reading through your book, I was thinking you could write a whole other book about the history of like masculinity and healthcare and men's healthcare. Book two, maybe?
Oh, I love that. Well, you asked me about burnout in medicine. And one of the things that reinvigorated my love of caring for patients was the chance to breathe and think about our healthcare system and to write this book. It was such a passion and joy and love of mine to be able to write this book. I would be honored to write another book. Of course, I have many ideas. I would also love to be involved in teaching medical students and the future and helping to shape the future of those interested in medicine. So hopefully they can be inspired the way that I've been inspired and to really realize how sacred and privileged it is to take care of the next human being. And there's always ways that we could do better. And this book allowed me to access that passion again. And I would love to be able to write another book.
Write another book, but rest and not burn out in the meantime.
Let's hope. Let's hope.
Well, Dr. Coleman, it was such a pleasure to talk to you about this book. I feel like we could talk forever about all of the examples that you have, the historical examples that you have and how it ties into the present, and especially all of the very interesting characters that make their way through the book. My mouth dropped open a few times for some of the characters that I was not familiar with. So, you know, again, thank you for writing it, and I hope that everyone gets a chance to read it.
Thank you so much. And thank you for all that you do. I'm inspired by your work as well, tremendously. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Afterwards podcast. If you are interested in podcasts about nonfiction books, listen to C-SPAN's Book Notes Plus podcast for interviews with authors and historians hosted by Brian Lamb.